A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
So Daniel sent us this one, and I love where his head's at. He's been watching Hannah, that's his wife, the architect, do this thing where she walks into a crumbling building and sees not the cracked plaster and sagging beams, but the finished home. The exposed brick, the light pouring through a window that doesn't exist yet. And he realized it's not just an architect's trick, it's a cognitive skill that applies to hiring, to personal projects, to how you look at a country or a relationship. The ability to form a vivid internal model of what something could become, not just what it is. His question is basically, what do we call this thing? How does it work? And can the rest of us learn to do it?
And he's right that it's a superpower. I've watched Hannah do this. She'll walk a client through a renovation before a single wall comes down, describing where the morning light will hit the kitchen counter, and the client goes from skeptical to sold in about 90 seconds. It's not salesmanship, it's something else.
So what exactly is this ability, and how is it different from just being a positive thinker?
That's the key distinction, and most people get it wrong. Optimism is a general disposition. Things will probably work out. The future will be better than the present. It's a feeling. What Daniel's describing is a specific cognitive operation. You're constructing a detailed, actionable mental model of a future state that doesn't exist yet. An optimist looks at a dilapidated house and says, "I'm sure it'll be fine." Hannah looks at the same house and sees the exact placement of the skylight, the flow from kitchen to dining room, the way the original floorboards will look once they're refinished. That's not optimism, that's a render.
And Daniel makes that point himself, actually. He calls it building your own internal render. Like a 3D engine that takes raw geometry and computes lighting and textures and shadows. You feed it inputs, a space, a person, a situation, and it outputs a finished vision.
The render metaphor is perfect, because rendering is computationally expensive. It takes processing power, and that's exactly what's happening in the brain.
To answer the naming question, we need to go back about 2,400 years to a philosopher who gave this phenomenon a name.
Aristotle. He coined a word that I think is one of the most useful concepts in all of philosophy, and almost nobody uses it in everyday conversation. Entelechy. E-N-T-E-L-E-C-H-Y. It comes from three Greek roots, en, meaning in, telos, meaning end or purpose, and ekin, meaning to have. So entelechy literally means having the end within. It's the principle of something carrying its own completed form inside itself, like a seed containing the tree it's meant to become.
Which is exactly the example Aristotle used. An acorn has the entelechy of an oak tree. The oak isn't imposed on the acorn from outside. It's already there, latent, waiting for the right conditions to actualize. The acorn isn't optimistic about becoming a tree. It just has that potential encoded in its structure, and given soil and water and sunlight, it unfolds toward that end.
And here's where it gets interesting for Daniel's question. Entelechy isn't just a biological concept for Aristotle. He applied it to everything. A block of marble has the entelechy of a statue. A child has the entelechy of a fully realized adult. The potential is real. It's present in the thing itself, but it requires someone who can see it and the right conditions to bring it out. When Hannah looks at a building, she's seeing its entelechy. When Daniel looks at a pile of hardware components and sees a finished computer, same mechanism.
I do that with lunch ingredients. The entelechy of a sandwich.
You do it with napping spots, mostly.
Also true. I can look at a patch of sunlight on the floor and see a perfect afternoon. But go on.
The point is, entelechy gives us a framework that's more precise than seeing potential. Potential is vague. It's just possibility. Entelechy is directional. It's potential with a trajectory. The acorn isn't going to become a giraffe. It's going to become an oak tree, and the specific shape of that oak is already encoded. When you're good at seeing entelechy in people or situations, you're not just imagining random positive outcomes. You're reading the actual trajectory that's already present.
That's a crucial distinction. Daniel's not talking about wishful thinking. He's talking about pattern recognition applied forward in time. You look at a junior developer, and you don't just hope they'll be great. You see specific signals, how they ask questions, how they respond to feedback, how they think about problems. Those signals encode a trajectory, and you're rendering the endpoint of that trajectory.
So let's talk about what's happening in the brain when someone does this. There's a network called the Default Mode Network, or DMN. For a long time, neuroscientists thought the DMN was just the brain's idle mode. It activates when you're not focused on an external task, when you're daydreaming or letting your mind wander. But over the past couple of decades, research has shown it's actually the brain's simulation engine. It's what lets you do mental time travel, remembering the past and projecting into the future. It's also what lets you do counterfactual thinking. What if I had taken that other job? What if this room were arranged differently? What if this person were given the right mentorship?
So the default mode network is literally the hardware that runs the internal render.
And here's what's fascinating. Studies show that when people are asked to imagine future events in vivid detail, the DMN lights up like crazy. But the quality of the simulation varies enormously between individuals. Some people generate blurry, abstract futures. I'll be successful, or the house will be nice. Other people generate high-resolution futures with sensory detail and causal chains. The second group aren't just more imaginative, they're running a more computationally intensive simulation. And that skill correlates with things like better decision-making, greater persistence through difficulty, and lower anxiety about the future.
Because if your internal render is high resolution enough, the future stops being a source of anxiety and becomes a destination you can navigate toward.
Right. Anxiety loves ambiguity. When the future is a fog, your brain fills it with worst-case scenarios. But when you've rendered it in detail, when you can see the staircase and the light fixtures and the way the kitchen opens onto the garden, the fog clears. You're not worrying about whether the renovation will work, you're problem-solving how to get from here to there.
And this connects to something Daniel mentioned that I want to sit with for a second. He brought up that Hebrew expression, "The people of Israel are not scared of a long journey." Am Yisrael lo mefashte, mi derech arukah. It's a strange motivational phrase when you think about it. It doesn't say the journey will be easy, or short, or pleasant. It says, we know where we're going, so the length of the road doesn't frighten us.
It's the entelechy of a nation. The destination is so vivid, so deeply encoded in the collective imagination, that the present suffering becomes bearable. Not because anyone is minimizing the difficulty, the phrase acknowledges that the journey is long, but because the vision of the destination provides a kind of gravitational pull.
And this is where I think Daniel's insight about resilience is really sharp. He's saying that resilience isn't just about disaster-proofing, stockpiling supplies, having insurance, building redundancies. Those are defensive resilience strategies. They protect you from what might go wrong. But entelechy is an offensive resilience strategy. It pulls you toward what could go right.
The best resilience systems combine both. You need the defenses, the backup generator, the emergency fund, the contingency plans. But you also need something worth defending. A vision compelling enough to make the hardship meaningful. Viktor Frankl wrote about this after surviving the Holocaust. The people who made it through weren't necessarily the physically strongest. They were the ones who had a future they needed to live for. A book they needed to write? A child they needed to see again? A purpose that wasn't yet fulfilled.
Frankl called it the will to meaning, and meaning requires a future orientation. You can't find meaning in pure survival mode. Meaning comes from the story you're telling about, where this is all heading.
So we've named it, and we know how it works in the brain. But what does this mean for how we actually live our lives?
Let's get practical. Daniel brought up hiring, and I think that's one of the most concrete applications. The difference between hiring for current output and hiring for entelechy.
Most hiring processes are backward-looking. They scan resumes for past accomplishments. They test for current skills. They ask about what you've already done. And that makes sense. It's measurable, it's defensible, it's easy to compare candidates. But it completely misses the thing Daniel's talking about. The junior developer who doesn't have the track record yet, but has a trajectory that's unmistakable if you know how to read it.
So how do you read it? What are the signals?
I'd look for a few things. One, rate of learning, not what they know now, but how fast they acquire new skills. Someone who taught themselves 3 programming languages in 6 months has a steeper trajectory than someone who's been writing the same language competently for 5 years. 2. How they respond to being wrong. The best indicator of future growth is what happens when you correct someone. Do they get defensive, or do they light up and ask follow-up questions? 3. Intellectual restlessness. Are they satisfied with knowing how to do something, or do they need to understand why it works?
Those are all entelechy signals. You're looking at the acorn and assessing whether it has the encoding to become an oak, rather than measuring how tall the sapling is today.
And the counterintuitive thing is, sometimes the candidate with the highest current output is actually a worse bet. They might have plateaued. They might be optimizing for looking good in their current role rather than growing into the next one. The person with the steepest growth curve often looks unremarkable on paper.
There's a famous example of this, or at least a famous story. When Steve Jobs returned to Apple in the late 90s, the company was bleeding cash and had a product line so confusing that nobody could explain the difference between the Performa and the Quadra. Most analysts looked at Apple and saw a dying company. Jobs looked at it and saw, well, he saw what it became. The most valuable company on Earth. He wasn't being optimistic. He was reading the entelechy of the situation, the design talent, the brand loyalty, the core technology that was being squandered by bad management.
And that's the thing about seeing entelechy. It often looks irrational from the outside. If you'd told someone in 1997 that Apple would be worth more than the entire German stock market, they'd have laughed. But Jobs wasn't predicting the future from data. He was rendering it from potential.
Let's talk about how to build this skill, because Daniel specifically asked, for those to whom this doesn't come naturally, can it be learned?
It absolutely can, and we know this from research on neuroplasticity and mental simulation training. Chess players train this deliberately. They don't just memorize openings, they spend hours visualizing board positions, 5, 10, 15 moves ahead and running simulations. Architects train it through years of looking at spaces and sketching what they could become. Engineers train it by working backward from a finished product to the components and processes needed to build it. None of these people were born with a fully developed internal render engine. They built it through deliberate practice.
So what's the practice? If I'm someone who looks at a messy room and just sees a messy room, how do I start seeing the finished space?
Daniel's render metaphor gives us the blueprint. A 3D renderer follows a pipeline. Gather raw geometry, define the lighting model, apply textures, run the simulation, output the image. You can train the same pipeline in your head. Step 1. Gather raw data. Spend time with the thing as it actually is. Not what you wish it were, not what you're afraid it is, what it actually is. Hannah does a walk into a building and immediately start fantasizing. She spends time understanding the structure, the load-bearing walls, the plumbing, the natural light at different times of day. The render has to be grounded in reality, or it's useless.
So the first step is actually the opposite of imagination. It's radical honesty about the current state.
Step 2. Identify constraints. Budget, time, physics, zoning laws, whatever applies to your domain. Constraints aren't the enemy of creativity, they're what make the render possible. A render engine needs to know where the walls are before it can compute the lighting. Step 3. Generate multiple possible futures, not just one. Hannah doesn't walk into a building and see the one true renovation. She sees 3 or 4 different layouts, each with trade-offs. The skill is in generating alternatives and then selecting the most compelling one. Step 4. Flesh out the chosen future in sensory detail. What does it look like from different angles? What does it sound like? What does it feel like to be inside it?
The sensory detail part is crucial. And it's what separates a vague wish from an actual render. I want to lose 20 pounds is not a render. I see myself running up the stairs without getting winded, fitting into my favorite jacket, feeling light and energetic. That's a render. It's specific, it's sensory, and it's motivating in a way that a number on a scale isn't.
Because the brain responds to vivid simulation differently than it responds to abstract goals. There's fascinating research on this. When you imagine a future event in rich sensory detail, your brain encodes it almost like a memory. It becomes something you've already experienced rather than something you're hoping for. And that makes it easier to pursue because your brain treats the gap between current state and future state as a problem to be solved rather than a wish to be granted.
That's the mechanism behind the Hebrew phrase again. The destination is so vivid that the length of the journey stops being scary and starts being just a logistical problem.
Let me give you a concrete exercise. Daniel mentioned the before and after approach, and I think this is exactly right. Pick one thing in your life, a room, a project, a relationship, a career move. Spend 10 minutes writing a description of its future state, but write it in the present tense, as if you're already there. Include at least 3 sensory details. What do you see? What do you hear? What does it feel like physically? Don't write about how you got there. Just render the destination in high resolution.
This sounds like visualization, which a lot of self-help books recommend, but I think the IntelliKey framework makes it different. Visualization often feels like wishful thinking. Imagine yourself rich, imagine yourself successful. IntelliKey is about reading the potential that's already encoded in the thing itself. You're not imposing a fantasy on reality, you're uncovering what's already latent.
That's the philosophical distinction that matters. IntelliKey isn't about positive thinking, it's about accurate thinking about potential. The acorn genuinely does contain the oak. The junior developer does have the trajectory to become a team lead. The dilapidated building does have good bones. The skill is in learning to read what's actually there, not in learning to imagine things that aren't.
And sometimes what's actually there is not much. Sometimes the IntelliKey of a situation is decline. The acorn is rotten. The building needs to be torn down. The candidate has plateaued. Being good at seeing potential doesn't mean seeing potential everywhere. It means being accurate about where the potential actually exists.
Which brings us to a misconception worth addressing. Some people here see the potential and think it means ignoring current problems. Putting on rose-colored glasses. That's not what we're describing. The best potential seers are acutely aware of current constraints. They just don't let those constraints define the future. Hannah sees the cracked plaster and the sagging beams more clearly than most people would. She just also sees what's possible beyond them.
It's like a doctor looking at a patient. You don't ignore the symptoms. The symptoms are your raw data. But you also don't confuse the current illness with the patient's permanent state. You're treating the person they're becoming, not just the condition they're in.
That's the pediatrician in me nodding vigorously. Kids are pure IntelliKey. You're never treating the child they are today. You're always treating the adult they're becoming. Every medical decision is made with that future self in mind.
Let's make this concrete. Daniel asked for actionable steps. Here are 3 things you can do, starting today, to build your own internal render.
First, the before and after exercise I mentioned. Pick one thing, a physical space, a project, a skill you want to develop, and write a present tense description of its future state with at least 3 sensory details. Do this for 10 minutes. Don't edit, don't judge, just render.
Second, when you're evaluating people or opportunities, ask a specific question. What is the IntelliKey here? What is this person or situation trying to become? Not what do I wish it would become. What is the trajectory that's actually encoded in it? This shifts your focus from judgment to cultivation. You stop asking, is this good enough now? And start asking, what does this need to unfold?
And third, use the internal render technique for goal setting. Most people set goals as abstractions. I want to be healthier, I want to save more money, I want to learn guitar. Those are goals, they're categories. Render the future instead. I see myself playing Blackbird on the guitar while my kid sings along, slightly out of tune, on a Sunday afternoon. That's a render. And when the practice gets hard, and it will, you're not grinding through scales for an abstraction. You're building toward a scene you've already lived in your head.
The more vivid the render, the more gravitational pull it exerts. That's the mechanism behind every successful long-term project. The person who renovated their own house over 3 years of weekends didn't do it because they're disciplined. They did it because they could see the kitchen they'd be cooking in, and that vision was more real to them than the exhaustion.
And this is why I think Daniel's right that this skill is almost a superpower. In a world that feels increasingly harsh and unforgiving, the ability to see potential is an act of rebellion. It's choosing to see what could blossom rather than what's decaying, not as denial, as strategic vision.
It's the difference between being a critic and being a cultivator. Critics are everywhere, and they're useful. You need people who can see what's wrong. But cultivators are rarer, and they're the ones who actually change things. They look at the same broken system, or struggling person, or empty lot, and see what it's trying to become.
And the beautiful thing is, once you start practicing this, it becomes a habit. You start seeing IntelliKey everywhere. Not because the world has changed, because your internal render engine has gotten faster and higher resolution. You've trained it.
So as we wrap up, I want to leave you with one question to sit with. What would change in your life if you started seeing potential everywhere? In people, in places, in situations you've written off? Not as a forced positivity exercise, but as an honest assessment of what's latent and waiting to unfold. What would you see that you're not seeing now?
And here's the forward-looking thought I want to plant. As AI gets better at predicting outcomes and optimizing for efficiency, the uniquely human skill may not be predicting the future. It may be envisioning it and willing it into being. Machines can forecast. They can extrapolate from data. But IntelliKey, reading the potential that's encoded in a person or a situation and nurturing it into reality, that requires something that looks a lot like wisdom. And wisdom is still very much a human domain.
If this episode resonated with you, please leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. And if you have a weird prompt of your own, send it to us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everyone.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
And I'm Korn. Thanks for listening.
And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the high medieval period, Kamchatkan observers recorded what they believed was a permanent dark blemish on the moon's northern limb. It was later corrected. They had been tracking a recurring libration effect where the moon's apparent wobble periodically brings the edge of the Mare Humboldtianum into view, creating the illusion of a stationary surface feature that isn't actually fixed.
So they spent decades cataloging a wobble.
Respectable dedication to being wrong. Thanks, Hilbert.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.